I'm your brother Fire Mary Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now,
the definition.
Did someone ask for a list of the richest people on the planet? Okay, here it is. Number 1, Jeff Bezos, Amazon. Number 2, Bill Gates, Microsoft. Number 3, Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway. Number 4, Bernard Arnault, Louis Vuitton. Number 5, Amancio Ortega, Zara. Number 6, Carlos Slim Helou and family. Number 7, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook. Number 8, Larry Ellison, Oracle. Number 9, Larry Page, Alphabet, co-founder of Google. Number 10, Charles Koch, Koch Industries. Number 11, David Koch, you guessed it, Koch Industries. Number 12, Sergey Brin, Google. Number 13, Michael Bloomberg, Bloomberg. Number 14, Ma Huateng, Tencent Holdings. Number 15, Jim Walton, Walmart. Number 16, Rob Walton, Walmart. Number 17, Alice Walton, Walmart. Number 18, Steve Ballmer, Microsoft. Number 19, Francois Betancourt Myers and family, L'Oreal. Number 20, and our guy, Mukesh Ambani. Ah, we just love lists here at Mr. Luxury.
Industrial and Social Democracy by Eugene V. Debs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. American Socialist, May 27, 1915. First of all, allow me to quote with approval the following paragraph from An Introduction to Sociology by Arthur Morrow Lewis. The greatest single achievement of the science of sociology is the concept of society not as a collection of institutions, and sociology as an explanatory catalog or inventory, after the fashion of Spencer, but as a process of development, and the science of sociology as the analysis and explanation of the process. Also the following from An Essay on Revolution by George D. Heron. Every revolution or true reform, every new and commanding faith, is in the direction of man's becoming his own evolver and creator. Every uplifting light or law perforces, in the place of the evolution that is blind and chanceful, an evolution that is chosen and humanly directed. There is still room for reform and betterment in the present social system, but this is of minor consequence compared to the world's crying need for industrial and social reorganization. The next great change in history will be, must be, the socialization of the means of our common life. Privately owned industry and production for individual profit are no longer compatible with social progress and have ceased to work out to humane and civilized ends. With all its marvelous progress through invention and discovery, and all its monumental achievements in the arts and sciences, this poor world of ours has not yet learned how to feed itself. That is the problem of problems now confronting us more and more insistently, and until that is solved, the world is halted, and it will either resume its march towards industrial and social democracy, or be shaken to its foundation, and into possible chaos by violent explosion. There is no longer the shadow of an excuse for a hungry being. All the laws, all the materials, and all the forces are at hand and easily available for the production of all things needed to provide food, raiment, and shelter for every man, woman, and child, thus putting an end to the poverty and misery, widespread and appalling, which now shock and sicken humanity and impeach our vaunted civilization. But these tools and materials and forces must be released from private ownership and control, socialized, democratized, and set in operation for the common good of all, instead of the private profit of the few. It is well stated that civilization is at present rudimentary, and that it is to develop indefinitely. Now, in view of the fact that the crops this year, 1914, are the most abundant ever produced, that there is no market for the almost 16 million bales of cotton lying in the warehouses, while at the same time there are millions of unemployed in the land who are without food and without clothing, and who, with their wives and children, are doomed to indescribable suffering. In view of this solemn and indisputable fact, it would seem that there could be but one opinion among students and thinkers as to the one great, vital, and essential thing to do for the relief of our common humanity and for the promotion of the world's progress and civilization, and that that one thing is the one to be emphasized with all the power at our command. A privately owned world can never be a free world, and a society based upon warring classes cannot stand. Such a world is a world of strife and hate, and such a society can exist only by means of militarism and physical force. The education of the people, not the few alone, but the entire mass, in the principles of industrial democracy and along the lines of social development, is the task of the people to be emphasized. And that task, let it be impressed upon them, can be performed only by themselves. The cultured few can never educate the uncultured many. All history attests to the fact that all the few have ever done for the many is to keep them in ignorance and servitude, and to live out of their labor. To stir the masses, to appeal to their higher, better selves, to set them thinking for themselves, and to hold ever before them the ideal of mutual kindness and goodwill, based upon mutual interests, is to render real service to the cause of humanity. To quote Heron once more, "Socialism is a deliberate proposal to lay the will of man upon the unfolding processes and ends of nature and history. It invokes the faith that shall be equal to the acceptance of its proposal, of its supreme challenge to the universe." End of Industrial and Social Democracy.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Mayor Diesel Gaia. And this is a Class War Battlefield podcast. Addendum for the episode titled A Message to the Wealthy. Get rid of your taxes today. I was re-listening to it, and I kind of lost track of one of the primary points that I was making at the start of the entire episode, and I went off in a completely different direction than I intended to. So I want to pick up the theme that I had at the beginning of the episode, which is pay people what they're worth. Now, how is this going to result in tax people getting rid of their own taxes? Now, granted, look, because of the nature of capitalism and the fact that some people are allowed to amass obscene amounts of wealth, and that obsceneness has changed and evolved and grown significantly over the past 60 years comparative to what was obscene 110, 120, 130, 150 years ago. Comparatively, I mean, they were, those people were dealing with like pennies and dimes compared to what a lot of these folks today are dealing with. That, though, doesn't change the fact that even in their day, they were allowed to amass obscene amounts of wealth for those days. So, because these people, based on capitalist principles, which no capitalist ever goes by these principles, these things only apply to you and I, but because they are allowed to amass amazing and obscene amounts of money, their taxes are always going to be significantly higher, and they should be, because as I pointed out, and as I point out in the third portion to this entire thing, to this entire episode, it is the average person doing their work daily through the process of employment that allows the obscene wealth to be amassed in the first place. I won't speak too much on that right now because that is for that third portion. But the question that I know you probably have is, well, wait a minute. How could the wealthy paying us what we're worth lower their taxes? Well, if they were paying you what you were worth, and that is a fair amount of what you are actually producing, and a fair amount would be 50 to 60% of what you are producing for them, which they'll never do that, because then you would be making $80,000, $90,000, $100,000, $200,000 a year. And the calculations that they do in their heads leaves them to believe that you aren't worth that much money. If they were to pay you what you were worth, though, that would mean that their tax burden, some of their tax burden, would shift onto you because your tax brackets would shift upwards. Now, you might say, well, that's not fair. That wouldn't be fair. That wouldn't be fair. Actually, it would be fair. Many of the social problems that we are experiencing comes from the lack of investment, significant investment in society. Society just does not happen. Community just does not happen. It has to be a deliberate, calculated, altruistic plan that seeks to build community and maintain community for the sake of society. And that means planning and maintaining communities in their ability to remain stable internally and stable externally. And that stability from an external perspective means that community is going to have to engage in some intercommunity and transcommunity planning. They're going to have to be willing to help other communities remain stable so that they can remain stable. Now, in the way that capitalist America has figured out how to accomplish this, most of the transcommunal planning surrounds policing. The idea of keeping another community stable is seen as something that policing can do the best, because most of the places that need to be kept stable have to be exploited significantly and kept in high poverty so that money can be extracted out of those places. That, though, is a horse of a different story, you know. So, taxes on all levels can be utilized to build this community and to build society on multiple levels. I just said that. But it's important to recognize that, because that's what you're paying for when you pay taxes. Now, nobody likes high tax bills. However, if taxes are done correctly, taxes are both affordable and they're helpful. Now, to what extent they can be affordable and helpful depends on society and the needs and the ability of the legislature to keep the pricing mechanisms in the society affordable, so that whatever has to come out of the public purse doesn't go towards largesse in making somebody who already has tons of money even more wealthy. And unfortunately, and I do mean this sincerely, unfortunately, many people see the government as a piggy bank, which helps them get richer and richer and richer. Now, you don't do that, but a lot of wealthy people do that. And that is something that we learned about during the Iraq War. Remember Halliburton and many of the other companies that went over to Iraq and spent very little on the projects that they had to complete, but they charged the federal government obsessively obscene amounts. And yeah, I'm liking that word obscene today, y'all. But they did. They charged them a lot of money to do shoddy work, including for the troops. You know, a lot of you support the troops, but were not angered by what Halliburton and them did to the troops while over in Iraq, which was always frustrating to me. Anyway, but I digress, I digress. So, some of the ways that the tax burden gets shifted to people when they're paid more is somewhat obvious. The first one, obviously, is when you get paid more, you have a higher income tax rate. Now, here's what's funny, ladies and gentlemen, because many of you are, you know, rolling your eyes at that, like, oh yeah, of course, you know, government's going to want more, yada, yada, yada. But let me ask you something. Most of you who are listening to this probably never had the opportunity or never made $100,000 in a year. I have never made $100,000 in a year. But I decided to, you know, do some math about 2 years back. Because I was having this discussion with the guy out on the street about what is a fair wage. He was not for the fight for 15 at the time. And I told him that I thought 15 was actually you know, being generous to the corporations who could easily, most of the larger ones especially, start off paying people $23, $24 an hour and not miss it. He was obviously not for that. It didn't matter. I mean, I also argued to him that I really believe that in this country people should be making no less than $52,000 a year. I decided, though, to do some backhanded math once when I was done speaking to him. Back of the napkin math. Where I figured out, you know, what would making $52,000 a year actually mean? Or what would making, $100,000 a year actually mean? Now, to start off, you could easily, making $52,000 a year, most people could easily automatically put $10,000 into their retirement. So that's automatically from $52,000 to $42,000. You could invest easily in really good healthcare. Now, should you? No. In America, we should have free health care, and it's going to happen in the next 10 to 15 years. Trust me when I tell you that. And, you know, reining in corporations and pharmaceutical corporations and all that's going to happen. It will happen. It's just going to take some time. But, you know, you won't miss per week $100 or however much you have to pay for your insurance. Neither would you miss the income tax that'll suddenly hit you, which will, I think, sever about another $13,000 from you. It might just be 10. Don't quote me on either one of those numbers, though. And in fact, it might be under 10. It's been a long time since I looked at the brackets. No, it would definitely be more than 10, because you're dealing with over 20%. Anyway. So, automatically, you know, with taxes taken out and everything, you're starting out with about 32, I'm just going to say 30, I'm just going to say $30,000 with taxes, with insurance taken out. I'm going to say you're starting with $30,000 of spending money, okay? Now, that's still not that much. That's like $600 every week. Now, for some of you, you're like, not that much, man. Do you know what I could do with $600? It's still not that much. I mean, it's decent, but it's still not that much. Let's jump then, because I jumped then to $100,000. Now, with $100,000, you could easily put $30,000, $40,000 of that into your retirement. I mean, right off the bat, you could easily put $30,000 to $40,000, boom, right into your retirement. Then, you know, that would, let's just say you put $30,000, so now you're down to $70,000. That's going to decrease your tax rate immediately, but you're still going to drop about another $20,000 probably on taxes. So let's just pull that right off of there. So now you're down to $50,000. Maybe, you know, you'll spend another $5,000, you know, dollars for, or maybe it'll be more like $10,000 on insurance and everything. So now you're down to $40,000. You just went from having $30,000 less, or I'm sorry, to having $30,000 left, to $40,000 left, which takes you from around $600 to around $800 left over. It's likely, you know, you're not going to put $30,000 in, you'll probably put $25,000. It's also likely that you're going to find ways to decrease that tax burden. Either way, now you're talking about $3,200 a month of spending money, at least. It changes your whole perspective of what is possible with money. Now, obviously, this is about taxes, so I want to bring it back to that. But for the average person, I just laid out a scenario that all of you should be salivating over. I mean, $30,000 to $40,000, it'll probably be more around $50,000 if you were making $100,000. And for $52,000, it would probably be more around $35,000 to $38,000 if you were making $52,000. Depends on how much you really put away in your 401k. Anyway, what that increase in money does for you. One, when you have more discretionary spending, you do two things. When you have more money to spend, you do two things automatically. One, you are more willing to spend your money on luxury items. Now, a luxury item doesn't have to be a yacht or an expensive car. For the average person, a luxury item is, I'm a fan of this sports team, and I'm going to go to 4 or 5 games because I have the extra money. Or I'm going to go to 8 or 12 games because I have the extra money. Or I'm going to go to, you know, basketball games. Maybe I'm going to go to 20 games because I have the extra money. Now, most people don't have that kind of money. But if you were making what you were actually worth, you would. That then puts money into that team who then pays people locally. Now, even if they don't pay people that much locally, they still have to typically pay taxes. So now you're helping them pay their taxes. And you're helping other people make money so they can contribute to the tax base. It's all about you being paid fair, though. If you're not being paid fair, then you can't buy those luxury items. And so, therefore, it's harder to keep the local economy flowing when the average person doesn't have the extra money to not only contribute once, but contribute multiple times. Now, when I say contribute once, I mean that when you first get paid, you're contributing. That's your first contribution. The goal is to get you to contribute multiple times so that you can help hit the tax base from multiple places or through multiple points of entry. Now, additionally, when you have extra money, you may go out and not only spend money on food, but you may go out and buy extra clothes. Maybe you had your eye on some books that you wanted. Maybe you wanted to buy some new furniture. Or that new TV that you've been eyeing for a long time. All of those things have taxes attached to them. All of them. Not only that, if those things are made domestically, and a lot of them aren't, but let's say some of them are, you are supporting domestic workers, which means you're helping them hit their taxes too. You're helping them pay for them. Now, this is something that I didn't create. This is something that Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, started talking about and started pushing for the elite to understand and to embrace and accept. Many people do not seem to get the importance of this single concept. If you pay people what they are worth, you help them help you decrease your tax impact so you don't have that much of a tax burden. There we go. And I do want to apologize for him. I'm going through a sinus thing here, but I'm going to push through this because this is important. The second thing that happens with the or the second thing that you do when you are paid what you are worth is you take opportunities that otherwise you wouldn't take, or you even take risks that otherwise you wouldn't take. When you have extra money, you're more likely to invest with friends in companies or businesses or startups that you normally wouldn't because you don't have the extra cash. See, this is another one of those things that wealthy people want to kind of monopolize. They want to be the ones who only build the businesses, who have to be, you know, brought in to finance startups. When if they would give you what you were worth, there would be 100 million people in this country that would eagerly put money into startups within their communities to build businesses. And not only build businesses, but keep those businesses right there in the community. Which, I know, some of you conservatives are listening and saying, oh, that sounds like socialism and communism. Well, it's kind of funny because when wealthy people get 30, 40, 100, 200 people together and invest in something, you call that capitalism. But when 50,000 or 100,000 people get together and invest in something that, you know, they don't use the stock market for, you call that communism and socialism. Huh. That's weird. That's odd. And it's unfair. Because if you're going to say that the market is free, but it's only free when wealthy people are collectively putting together their money to invest and steer something, then you are essentially saying that this is an authoritarian system, capitalism is, where the wealthy can do as they damn well please. They can get together and exercise their power all they want. But if the average citizens get together and exercise their powers, then that, according to capitalism, is incorrect. That is not supposed to be how it's done. The average citizen has no power except for, I want to pay my money to this wealthy person, to this capitalist. Or the average citizen, though, has no investment power. Like, they cannot bring together their friends and neighbors and people to invest wholesale in startups or in companies to stir them. Nope, it has to be wealthy people who are doing all that work. That is the argument you're making. And so, if that's the argument you're making, I'm fine with that. And I know you would disagree with that. But that's really what it comes down to. When you make that distinction, the wealthy can collectively pool their money and do this, but ordinary citizens can't. That's an authoritarian system where the normal average everyday person has no real power. They're just cash cows for the wealthy. I'm not a fan of that. What's interesting, though, and I'm moving away from that topic back to the original one, is that the amount of points of entry that I just talked about are really only scratching the surface when it comes to things that actually impact taxes. I mean, think about this, right? Think about if Detroit, the people of Detroit, back in during the Great Depression era, were given the opportunity to own significant amounts or some amounts of the automobile industry that powered Detroit back in those days. And let's say people took the federal government up on that idea. Now, you would say socialism, communism. I would say insurance.
Oh, well, it's communism and socialism because the people are owning the industry. That means the government is owning. I never said anything about the government owning the industry. No, this is the people owning it. Now, the stock market does the same thing, by the way. You just have to go to a broker who acts as a middleman for you. I mean, you could do it online, too, now, I guess. But the stock market does the same thing. You can have a company that literally has a million people owning shares in it. Those shares get traded every day, and that company's price of those shares go up and down. But the moment I say that a people living in an area own significant amounts of a company or an industry that keeps their community stable, the moment I say that, oh, well, it's not capitalism. It's communism. It's socialism. Well, let me ask you this. For the people in Detroit, if you took a poll of 100,000 people in Detroit, those who are still there, and those maybe, you know, you track down a like 10 or 15,000 of them who moved across the country, if you ask them if they could go back to the Great Depression and encourage the people living in Detroit to buy significant amount of stocks in the automobile industry in the region at the time, and you explain to those people how in, you know, 80 years, the automobile industry had shrunk significantly and a lot of those plants had moved overseas. And then you explain to them further that if those people purchased those purchased those stocks, then they could have a say in whether or not those companies left. I'm thinking a lot of those people would be like, you crazy. That ain't never going to happen. Detroit's never going to fall. But with a little bit of prodding, I think those people would be like, okay, let's do this. Let's do this. Let's make sure that we own, you know, 22% of the stocks of all of these companies, or maybe just for, you know, just for S's and G's, maybe we own 32 or 33% just to make sure that they are the majority stakeholder. And I think a lot of people, after some convincing, would be like, yeah, let's do that, because we can keep these companies home. We can keep these companies here. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing that, you know, we are really that brainwashed where it's like, well, capitalists say this, but it's communism if you do it for the normal people. Anyway, from a tax perspective, think about what that would have meant for Detroit to have 33% of those companies owned by the people in Detroit. You know, you might have 2 or 3 or 4 million people in the area owning what would amount to 33% or higher of those companies. Do you think that those millions of people would have allowed those companies to take those plants and move them overseas if they were stakeholders? Heck no. Do you think the tax base in and around Detroit would have collapsed the way it has because those plants have left? No. But again, the only way that that would have happened is if those companies were paying those people what they were worth. And we know We know, thanks to the New Deal, that specifically, I was going to say after World War II, but even during World War II and prior to World War II, thanks to New Deal, people were getting paid pretty good money. And meaning they had the disposable income enough to make that plan real. I live about 50 minutes, maybe closer to an hour now, from two great companies, Xerox and Kodak. There were some terrible mistakes made by both of those companies, which has left them as shells of their former selves. They're still ticking along, but they are shells of their former selves. And both companies have offshored a lot of their profitable operations and a lot of their operations altogether. And I can't help but to think, if the community surrounding Kodak and Xerox owned a significant stake of those stocks, then maybe they wouldn't have offshored so many of those plants and what have you. Maybe. But that's not speculation. Even though I said two things, I think I'm going to go for three, and in fact, I might have already hit three, but either way. Another thing people like to do when they have extra money, when they're getting paid what they're worth, is have children, buy a home, have a home, get married. When people aren't worried about money, they have more time for socializing, which helps local businesses. And they're more likely to have children. Now, they ain't going to have a ton of them, but they will have children, and they'll spend money on them. They'll save money for them. They'll, you know, plan for their future as long as they have the extra cash, which, again, shifts some of the tax burden onto, from the wealthy onto the people who they're paying. Because when you have the extra money and you can plan for your future, for your children, that means you don't need the government as much in the planning of that future and in making that future happen. Now, granted, you know, thanks to the GI Bill and many of the New Deal programs that were negotiated before Roosevelt's death that became more crystallized after his death in other programs that people don't typically associate with the New Deal, which led to the growth of communities and housing and all this other stuff that people take for granted today. That generation, baby boomers, well, technically their parents, the parents of the baby boomers, were able to do exactly that. They were able to have families. They were able to buy homes and spend their discretionary cash on all sorts of luxury things that we couldn't even dream of doing today because we don't get paid what we are worth. Moreover, because the tax laws focused heavily on not making corporations pay their federal taxes, but pay taxes to the communities which they operated in, and then state and then federal. And if they wanted, if the companies didn't want to do that, then the government was like, oh yeah, well, that's cool. We'll impose all these taxes on you, which you could write off if you would just do what was right. But because they focused on that, that gave the ability to build society, build stable communities to the locals. Was it always for the best? No. But did it work most of the time? Yes, which is exactly why corporations wanted to get rid of it. They know the confidence that is built when you are getting paid what you deserve to get paid, what you are owed, what you are worth. And if I can speak a little freely here, their goal really is to stop that from happening. Because once you really figure out the empowerment that comes with getting paid what you are worth and what you are owed, once you figure out the empowerment that comes from knowing that you are contributing to the building up of your community through your taxes and understanding how your taxes are applied to making your life better and your children's lives better and all the people who you know and don't know, their lives better. Well, you then start looking at the corporations like, you're stopping us from living our best lives just so you can have more money. And you don't even want the more money for anything, or you don't even want the money, the more money. You don't even want the money for anything that matters. You just want it so you can hoard it. And not only so you can hoard it, but basically you want it so you can keep it away from us, which is even more sick and more diabolical because you are causing people to lapse into poverty and destructive actions just so that you can keep money. And then you start looking at them like, okay, you're a problem. And either you fix that problem or we'll fix the problem. Corporations are not stupid. They know this happens. They saw this happen, even though they didn't describe it in this manner, back in the 1930s and the 1940s and the 1950s. Lesser so in the 50s. Definitely in the 30s and the 40s. And so the goal really is to keep you ignorant of that structure of thinking. Why do you think corporations have put huge amounts of money? I'm talking billions of dollars here. Like, nobody, so far as I could tell, has really done the research, the book necessary to track these vile networks. And I've seen a couple of books, but it's almost laughable to me because the books are like, you know, my favorite still is Republican Noise Machine, but there's another one that I'm completely forgetting the name of. I don't have it yet. But the books are like usually a couple hundred pages. You know, and I'm like, no. We need a book the size of Adam Tooze's Crash. I think it was 700-something pages, which really goes into detail about these networks, which these rich people have put together to feed propaganda down your throat, in your ears, all day, every day, to get you thinking in a way that they want you thinking. I mean, seriously, y'all, do you think it's coincidence that throughout the country, people believe that the media is very liberal? Though, if you ask them to list two or three liberal radio stations, not hosts, radio stations, with majority liberal commentators, I guarantee you most people ain't going to be able to do that. Because unless you're listening to, like, black radio stations or radio stations like Pacifica, or I know I'm missing a couple of them, so I apologize, but basically unless you're in very strong liberal areas, good luck. You ain't finding many radio stations that are not conservative, especially in the middle of the country. And that's by design. If you allow folks to not be around this type of propaganda, and truthfully, the wealthy have figured out that the key to holding America hostage is holding the Midwest. Is holding the Midwest. If you allow the people, though, to finish my earlier thought, if you allow them to think for a substantial amount of time, what happens is they see through the lies and the fog and the distortions. Now, I'm not claiming that everybody does this, because everybody doesn't do it. Driftglass likes to call some people reprogrammable meatbags. And that's just so wrong. Oh, man. But it's kind of true. Reprogrammable meatbags. RPMs. And oh, man, that's funny. Wow. He's kind of right about that, though. I've met a few people like that where I'm like, God, Jesus, you can't be this daft. And then I talk to him for a minute, and I'm like, yep, you're this daft. Lemons. Yeah, if you let them think for too long, then, you know, people will see through the lies. And the ones who don't, you know, you ain't never going to talk to them anyway. They are the authoritarian personalities that, oh my God, I can't think of his name now. Oh, I'm so sorry, y'all. But the authoritarian personalities that was mentioned in the book, The Authoritarians, that I often talk about, you know, they're always going to be there. But for the rest of us, we have to recognize that this is just the way things are, because they want to keep these lies going. They want to keep these lies going. Lastly, you know, in talking about this tax stuff, I want y'all to really understand me when I say we don't need to get rid of taxes so much as we need to make sure that people are getting paid what they're worth. It's funny because taxes, if they were done right, would go in waves. And I don't know if it would be a predictable wave or if they would have to be adjusted periodically. But if government was run correctly and people were getting paid via corporations what they were, you know, worth, and there was a plan for the next, let's say, 20 years, 10 years, we'll do 10 years, surrounding what government had to get done, you could actually fluctuate how much people owe in taxes every year according to what needed to actually get done. Now, for the first 10 years, there's a lot of things that need to get fixed in this country, so taxes wouldn't fluctuate that much. But the second 10-year period, the second decade, absolutely. It most likely, the tax burden sometime would start decreasing and may decrease through the whole next 10-year cycle. And then for the third 10-year cycle, maybe a little bit up for a while and then going back down, just because you got to keep those things fresh that you need to invest in. And after about 50 years, though, of this, the pattern would emerge, and you would be able to see, you know, what level taxes could be sustainably held at in order to keep the society healthy, stable, and rising. Now, the society's not always going to rise, and it's not always going to appear stable, especially with capitalism at its helm. But the data collected would allow us to implement a strategy to keep it as stable as possible. I want to thank you all for listening. I apologize for my voice. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, I always love hearing from you. If you have the extra cash, please support the show. $2, $5, $10, $20, $30, $50 a month. You know, whatever you can do, help me out, help me out, help me out. You can hit me up on PayPal, CWB Podcast. You can hit me up on Cash App, CWB Podcast. And I do know there's some issue with Cash App. So I'm working through that. You can also hit me up on Spotify and Anchor. Anchor allows you to actually put money there, put like, you know, drop money in. So you can do that through Anchor too. Anchor is ANCHOR.FM. It's a Spotify thing now too. But type in Class War Battlefield Podcast. Boom, I'll come up. I think there's a donate button or something to that effect there. You know, just drop me some dollars in there. And if you're having problems with the other spots, let's do this. So, obviously, love hearing from you guys. If you have any questions, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. I am your brother, Vimer Diesel Gaia. Thank you for listening to this portion. Enjoy the rest.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lives in the balance.